You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Joe Bowler back to the podcast. Joe is the Nomalini and Olivier Professor of Education at Stanford University. I hope I said that correctly. She is the author of 19 books and numerous research articles. She's got a terrific new book. It's called Mathish: Finding Creativity, Diversity, and Meaning in Mathematics. Check it out.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock. Mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the
Joe Bowler, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
You open your terrific new book with a story about a dinner you had in an expensive restaurant in Silicon Valley with the CEO of a major social media platform and his wife. You don't name who it is, and I'm not going to ask you to here. But what happened at that dinner, and why does it start your book?
Well, it really is a microcosm of what's been happening to me over the past few years, really. I was invited to go to dinner with the CEO and his wife. And as I explain in the book, he sat there at the dinner table and just carried on doing his work. He got out all his work papers. He was on the phone. So we were like, okay, we'll just talk without him, I guess. Mm-hmm. And eventually when the meal came, he started to pay attention to the rest of the table and immediately started telling me about all of his high maths achievement and the high maths, where he'd done really well in maths in different colleges and how good he was at maths. And then said, so you think maths should change, do you? In a very critical sounding voice. And I was like, oh, here we go.
Yep.
Because over time, I have found that people who've done really well in maths don't see any need to change anything. Even though only a third of students are successful, they see that as just, you know, a sign of their brilliance that they were successful and all these other people are not. So, that is kind of what's happening in my life all over the place now, that people are resisting maths change if they're really successful already.
I it just stuns me because Tucker Carlson went after you.
He did.
This is like, because you're trying to, it's so insane, because you think there are better ways to teach math and there is all the evidence in the world that is not taught well. And I'm certainly one of those people who always had math fear, felt I was bad at it. I happen to be very good in English. I am a musician. I use math all the time in my job.
You could have been great at maths in school, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, but you know, and it seems just so clear. But you know, this seems, and I don't know. I guess from your point of view, is it just using you as a prop for this other sort of argument that they're kind of do? Because they can't really. Tucker Carlson doesn't know how one teaches math.
Tucker Carlson does not know. And this, I was one of the writers of the California Maths Framework, which was proposing some really reasonable changes in the way we teach maths and paying attention to all students. And it was targeted by the people who are targeting other things.
Yeah.
It was called woke math. Taylor Tucker Carlson put my picture on his show and said this woman's bringing social justice into maths, which of course prompted multiple death threats. And it sort of went on from there that this group decided to target the framework. And then they thought, or it seemed, that if they could bring me down personally, then everything else would fall. And this is a tactic of people now, that they find a single person and try and discredit them and work with newspapers and lots of forms of media. And so it was pretty bad for me. It was not pleasant.
No, but you're still at it. Yes. The work is important and you're not backing down.
It's hard to stop because we know that there's a better way. We have tons of evidence that there's a better way. And I have seen so many people become kind of unlocked and ready to embrace maths and do really well in it. So, it's hard to give up on that when you know that you can help people with it.
There's so many times in the book where you're talking about people's perceptions to math and the way you think about it or think it should be taught, and the way that I think about our work. So my friend Jen Ellison has a term she uses for comedy, where she's like, at Second City, we're really looking for people to do thick comedy rather than thin comedy, because she wants it to be expressive and interesting and deep and multi-layered, and not a pun, which would be thin comedy. And you talk about narrow mathematics. So can you talk a bit about what that is?
Yeah, narrow maths is really what's in schools everywhere. And it's those short, closed questions where one method is valued and one answer, teachers are looking for one answer. And it's very procedural. And maths doesn't have to be like that. Any question in maths, we can open up the question and invite different ways of thinking about it, different ways of drawing it, visualizing it. What I'm proposing is not different maths. It's exactly the same maths. It's the same algebra. It's the same geometry. But just opening up those questions, making them more rich, exciting, more inspiring for students. It seems so clear to me that we need that. And we see the damage of students going through a narrow maths experience all over the place. It's really hard getting it to happen, though.
Yeah, which change is hard, right?
Change is hard, yeah.
And especially when people, the incentives are for them to perhaps think that things shouldn't change because they want to maintain their status. Right. I thought it was interesting, too. You talk about a Santa Clara University neuroscientist, I think it's Lang Chen, whose findings that show that students' attitudes towards math, whether they liked it or disliked it, correlated with their math achievement. But not their reading achievement. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And even this is after controlling for IQ scores, age, working memory, and math anxiety. So this feels like the science behind growth mindset, Carol Dressport.
Yeah, it is very similar. But what he showed that was kind of additional to what we know about mindset is your feelings about maths are actually affecting how your brain processes maths. It changes the hippocampus. So this isn't just you believe in yourself, because that's super important as well. That's the mindset piece. But what you think about maths, whether you like it or not, is actually going to change how your brain approaches it. One of the people I talk about in the book, Eugenia Cheng, is a mathematician. And in her book, she talks about why are we not spending more time just giving kids the joy of maths, helping them love it, helping them see the beauty in it. No grades, no pressure, no performance. It's just about enjoying and seeing the beauty of maths. And we need time for that in classrooms. We don't have it now, but it's certainly something important that's missing.
So talk about the fact, I never thought about it in this way, that unlike almost every other subject that I was taught in school, math is almost purely performance-based.
Yeah.
It's all tests.
It's all tests and grades, and it is unlike other subjects in that way. And people think that's what maths is. And the people who are opposed to me are on that bandwagon. They want it to be lots and lots of tests and grades. So that causes kids to think they're in a constant performance wheel. Got to keep, performing, can't drop, can't stop to think for a moment. You've got to just keep up these grades and tests, and there's no time for maths, Joy, in that system. And it's not surprising our kids are against maths when they're put through that all the time.
And I think, too, you highlight the fact that we don't think of mathematics in relationship. And this is that speaks to the sort of broader connectivity of we don't consider that you could be teaching math with regard to every aspect of how you live your life, your home, your hobbies, your sports, that sort of stuff. I mean, you were I loved the chart because we're both football fans, soccer football fans. But the charts in terms of, you know, where various kicks are going and goals. And I mean, anyone who loves basketball, though, you know, they see that stuff. Any of the sports, that's math. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's maths. And yeah, one of the things we're working on in our UCube Center is having lots of maths lessons that draw from data, real data in the world. So much more interesting for kids. Sports is just a whole goldmine of really interesting data, data visuals, things that kids can work out. I was in a school last week, a high school. And I was walking around and the kids were using something that's very popular at the moment, which is the teachers got them standing to do maths on whiteboards around the room. This is like a very big trend at the moment. And I like that. I have my own students stand and do maths on whiteboards in our rooms at Stanford. But what I saw was four kids kind of gathered around a whiteboard, just staring at it, doing nothing. And they had systems of equations. So it was like 3x plus 4y equals 4, 5x plus 2y equals 7. And I was walking around the groups and saying to the different kids, what do you think? How would you go about this? And they were like, dunno, group after group. And they didn't, I mean, why would you care about solving x and y? It has no meaning in their lives. And you see this in classrooms. Kids are now just thinking to themselves, why do I care about the result of this? So it's so easy to give kids a really rich problem that involves systems of equations. Maybe they're looking at the balance between birds and fish in an ecosystem, and actually the way one goes up, the other goes down, is a system of equation, and there's real data that they could look at and figure some things out. But too often, that's what kids are getting, just abstract equations, abstract numbers.
And the other problem, of course, and this is a cultural problem, is our fear of failure. And improvisation, what we know is the failure rate is extremely high, like it is in life and everything. So we have phrases like make mistakes work for you. We have there's a lovely way we open. There's a lovely way we open a lot of workshops, which is we have the audience applaud for everyone. Everything that they do, they applaud. Like, that's, we want you to bring that kind of energy to everything because there are no mistakes. That this, these are all, so you need to see all these obstacles as gifts that are being handed to you. And you highlight Carlos Cabana, the teacher, and that's exactly what he's doing in the classroom.
Yeah. Valuing those mistakes. I mean, we've really worked hard over the last 10 years now to get the message out that mistakes are really good for you. That's when your brain's really on fire with connectivity. When we teach students, we run camps at Stanford. We tell them we want you to struggle because that's when your brain's going to get this great workout. Mistakes are fantastic. We put them on the board. We talk about them. Kids are afraid of maths classrooms and they're afraid of making mistakes. And when you release them from that fear, they engage really differently. So that is a really key message. I love that improv people have repositioned mistakes, and that's what we need to do in maths too. And lots of teachers are doing that now. It's fantastic to see.
And I thought about you too, in terms of, yes, rethinking mistakes, but also rethinking mistakes inside the group. So Sheldon Patinkin, who is not a founder of Second City, but a mentor of mine and an early early director here, a teacher, he used to always say, you know, we all heard the phrase, your team is as only good as its weakest member. He says, I don't think that's true. I think your team is only as good as its ability to compensate for the weakest member, because each of us will be the weakest member at some time.
At some point, right? Yeah.
And this is the railside teachers, right? This is who you're talking about? Yeah.
That's what they did, a lot of work to make group work equal. They knew that, and I know this too, that if you go into a maths classroom and you say to the kids, work in groups, and you just don't do anything to help the group relationships, status differences come out. Somebody's left out, somebody feels really bad, somebody. And so they do a lot of work to help the students see that everybody's valuable in a group. They give them roles so they feel that they have something important to do, whatever the maths question. They do things to raise the status of any student that seems to be lower status in a group by really valuing what they say publicly. So it's a whole method of making group work equal. It's very effective. And yeah, it was great to be able to talk about those teachers in the book.
So, and this is this point too, which is you could call this DEI and you could call it diversity and use those words, and there shouldn't be any problem using those words. But there's other words that you could use this, which are being respectful, being curious, looking to elevate. I mean, I struggle to find the problem in those things other than people who are invested in keeping castes of individuals down.
That's right. Yeah, there is no problem in those things unless you're trying to keep the system as it is. And it is kind of a caste system in maths education. And that's what we see. Some people are successful. I don't think many people know that only 16% of students in the US take calculus in high school. And if you look at who those 16% of students are, it's horribly racially profiled. And everything is sort of set up for kids to get to calculus and to go on different pathways, but they don't get there anyway. So, and nor do they need to. Not everybody needs to take calculus, but the whole system is oriented around that and pushing kids out. Every time you go up through the grades, after about fourth grade, you're being filtered with more and more kids pushed out until we end up with that 16% at the top.
There's some great storytelling in the book, which none of which I knew. I didn't know about Andrew Wiles and Fermat's Last Theorem. Can you talk about that? I think it's a great story.
Yeah, Andrew Wiles. So Fermat is a mathematician from hundreds of years ago, Pierre de Fermat, as they say in French. And he came up with a statement that he said he had a wonderful proof for, but he didn't share the proof. So the statement was that if you take a number and square it and add it to another squared number, you can't get the next number squared for any number above 2. I think it was 2. Anyway, doesn't matter really. But he said, no, I can't prove. I can prove. Fermat said, I can prove that this is always true. And he didn't prove it. So this set mathematicians on a quest for hundreds of years to try and prove his theorem. And hundreds of years, and Andrew Wiles, an English mathematician, said that he came up with a proof. So this was like big news in the maths world. Hundreds of people turned up to see his proof. And it was at the Isaac Newton Institute in Cambridge, I think, that he gave this grand lecture, his proof of Fermat's Last Theorem, and there was a mistake in it. And so he went back to his study and worked for more months, maybe a year, and then came back and gave an actual proof. So it was a big deal. But what really interested me is that his mistakes spawned a new branch of mathematics and were extremely generative, the sort of mistaken thinking. So I put a quote in the book, I think, from Peter Simmons saying, out of the ruins of this failure, you know, came this amazing new mathematics. And so I share that with students. And it's a story that's helpful for students in a number of ways. One is they realize that real maths is not like a short answer, quickly give me the answer to this. People work on it for years. A problem that they could understand, a mathematician worked on for years. And so that's important for them. And then to hear that the mistakes were useful is part of our messaging we give to kids. We should value mistakes. There's always something good in a mistake that you can find. So the good teachers do that. They see where kids are going wrong and say, I see what you're thinking. And about this.
Yeah, my pal Heather Caruso is at UCLA now, and we worked together at the University of Chicago. She's a behavioral scientist, and she said it's a shame that there's not a database for the papers that don't get published, that fail, because we could learn so much from that if we just had that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, because if you look at scientific papers or maths papers or any of those, what you see is this beautiful product. And you don't see any of the thinking along the way. You don't see the mistakes. You don't see the thought processes. You just see this endpoint. And it would be so helpful for everybody, I think, if we actually saw more of that process.
So the book is called Mathish. What is an ish number?
This is my favorite part of the book at the moment. Good. So I propose in the book that in maths classrooms, numbers are almost always precise. That's a character of maths classrooms. But in the real world, when we engage with numbers, they're nearly always ish numbers. So I give some examples, like how much of the moon can we see tonight, or how long is the drive to the airport, or how much paint do I need to paint the room, or, you know, I could go on and on and on. How many people are in this crowd? We give ish numbers. And actually, probably, this is an ish number itself. Maybe 80% of the time we're giving ish numbers in the world. But in the classroom, it's all about precision. So it turns out that if you look at a calculation and you ish an answer, maybe you're thinking, what's 283 divided by 9? If people can give an ish answer to that, they're actually thinking conceptually about the numbers. They're not diving into a calculation. They're staying at that conceptual level, and they're showing that they have number sense. So I have an example in the book that I think is a really interesting one. Students in a standardized test were given 12 thirteenths plus 7 eighths. So two fractions that are very close to one. And they were asked which the answer was closest to, 1 to 19 or 21. So the majority of kids in the US chose 19, and the second most common was 21. So I know what's happening here. They're looking at these two fractions, 12 thirteenths and 7 eighths, and they're immediately calculating, add the numerators, subtract the denominators. They're not thinking, what's the ish number? And actually, I don't think kids ever think, what is the ish number? So I make this proposal in the book: before kids ever do a calculation, get them to ish the numbers first. That will keep them at this conceptual level. And so I have a video on, I made a website, mathish.org, and there's a video on there of sixth graders ishing. Mm-hmm. And the teacher took my idea and she said to the kids, come up with ish numbers before you come up with your actual numbers. So it totally opens up the classroom. Now we have these kids who never speak in maths, totally willing to give their ish numbers. And when we went and did our video, the principal was in the room. She was beaming from ear to ear. And she said, wow, these kids who are putting their hands up and engaging are usually outside my office because they're kicked out of classes. So it, as well as having kids sort of keep it at a more conceptual level, it frees them up. It makes them more willing. We've always had the word estimate in maths education. Mm-hmm. But kids hate to estimate. They're like, oh, another mathematical method. But when we ask them, give me your ish number, it does something amazing. So anyway, that's ish. I actually think it's not just numbers we can ish. We can ish all sorts of things in the world. And it's better when we do take an ish perspective a lot of the time.
It's playful. So I had to substitute teach a class at Northwestern for my wife because she's got a gig out of town with Second City that she's directing, and it's in the engineering department, and she's teaching mm-hmm. storytelling and improv exercises to make them more backable. We collaborated with Sunil mm-hmm. Gupta on this, and she did a thing where she's like, here's an exercise I want you to do, which is, here's the description, the title for this class that you're taking, and the description for the class. I want you to do two new versions of this, one for an affinity group at Northwestern, and one for any other population. You can be wild with it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was group work. And so they got in the groups, and I remember I came to them after like, I gave them a half hour. I came back, and they're like, can we have 10 more minutes? And it was said with such excitement because they were doing these really playful sort of descriptions. One of them was to the Mormon population that they would come to Northwestern to take this class and find God, you know, because who's more backable than Jesus was one of the taglines. And I realized bringing the sense of play mm-hmm. had them, you know, and these are all very highly skilled, you know, it's like your students, right? But freeing them up from this didn't take away from their number, mm-hmm. their number knowledge. Mm-hmm. It gave them a sense of the possibilities. Right. And every domain needs that.
And you actually, when you ish numbers, your brain is in a different place than when you jump in and calculate, more conceptual. I was sharing this at a workshop this past week, and one of the people in the workshop said, well, we didn't get to the moon by ishing numbers. And I said, well, actually, did we not? Because I was hearing from somebody also said her father was a rocket scientist. Mm-hmm. And he was saying how in the old days before calculators, they would ish numbers and then they would calculate them and they would know if they were in the right place or not. Now they just use calculators and there are mistakes all the time because nobody's ishing them. And so they could be out by thousands and they don't notice. So actually, this is something that's really helpful for engineers and for scientists getting us to the moon. So,
we have Cass Sunstein on the podcast recently for his book on fame, and he talks about a student who wanted to do research on, you know, attributes that all people who make it have. And she tried to make the case that it was people who had rough childhoods. And as he said, he's like, yeah, well, for every person who had a rough childhood who made it, you're going to find another person have a rough childhood who didn't. And he cites this as a confounding variable, which you talk about in the book as well. Can you explain what a confounding variable is?
Yeah. So I talk a bit about the most important ideas in maths. And one of them is in the area of data literacy. And so it's a big mistake that people often make, and it causes problems in their lives, is to see that two variables like appear together. You can draw a graph and they're matched, and presume that one causes the other, when actually they may both be together for a wholly different reason. And I give the example of a graph of shark. No, what is the graph I show?
It's shark attacks and ice cream.
And ice cream, that's right. So those correlate. Shark attacks and ice cream correlate. So you could just think, well, it's really dangerous to eat ice cream. But actually, both of them are being caused by another variable, which is hours of sunshine. Mm-hmm. So, there's not a lot of data things people need to be really function well in their life, but there's some really big ideas that are really important.
Well, and I think that one in particular, because we're dealing now with all the deep fakes and with propaganda and all those that, like, post-factual world, that's understanding right. that people might be trying to manipulate you with these things.
Yes. And this is one of our pushes in our work, is to get more data visuals in front of kids for them to interpret what do they mean, what data is there, who's sharing it, why are they sharing it, really helps them develop that data literacy, being more critical of data that's put in front of them. I see this with my own kids. You know, they sometimes say to me, look at this, that they see on Instagram or something. And I'm like, Is that real? I think we should look again at that. So it turns out that helping kids take a critical stance with data will protect them in this post-factual world that they're in.
All right. In a moment, we're going to ask you for a thank you because story. But before we do that, in the section where you talk about the really incredible, rich history of math section, where was zero invented?
Zero. Well, people have different ideas about this, but zero seems to have come from India.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our mathematics in the world, I mean, I share in the book the first awareness of decimal numbers and prime numbers came from a part of Africa, and Brazilian records were some of our earliest quantitative records that were kept. So maths itself has a beautiful, very rich cultural history, and that's something else our kids don't really get a lot of.
No.
So,
I was thinking about that too when I had to reset the timer. We have these lovely lights that, like Christmas lights that we have in our backyard. And when it rains, it shorts out. So I have to redo the timer, and it's in these sections of 12 and 12, right?
Yeah.
Is that Sumatra where that came from?
Yeah, the sundials.
The sundials.
It came from parts of Egypt. That's why we have our whole world has a 12-hour clock, is the way that they were looking at sundials. And they saw these 10 sections of shade from morning to night. And then they decided to add one for dusk and one for dawn, which gave them the 12 sections that we still use today.
So interesting. All right. Do you have a thank you because story for us?
Well, you know, I saw your request for where were you in a difficult conversation where you really disagreed with someone? And the one that came to my mind, and it's still so real for me, I have a daughter who's doing great in college, but has a lot of special needs, had auditory processing difficulties, could do amazing things, but tended to think more slowly, more deeply. And one of my memories was being called into a meeting at the school where everybody's there. The teachers are there, the special educators are there, and we're talking about what can we do to help. And it was in that meeting where the science teacher said, "Well, I know that Jamie cannot learn science." So that was a really hard one for me.
Yeah.
And I didn't say, "Well, thank you for that. I know you care about Jamie and you don't want to put her through hard things," or whatever he was thinking about. Actually, I was saved by the maths teacher, who was an amazing woman, who said, "Well, I find that really hard to believe because she asks the hardest questions in maths class that I can't answer as the teacher." So thank you to her for shifting that. But, you know, it's something I've seen in education for many years, teachers who don't believe in kids. And those are hard conversations. And I do try when I'm with those teachers to think of something good they've said and build on that rather than just say, you know, that's BS. Of course these kids can learn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because just as it's true that a single teacher can completely block a child's development, the opposite is true.
That's right. And we know that I meet people who have this experience so much. One teacher, they were doing so great in maths, and then their calculus teacher gave them the impression they couldn't do it. And that was it. That's the end of that. That was the end of their maths journey. And the other way around. I was the other way around. I had really boring maths teachers my whole life and then had an amazing calculus teacher. And she changed maths for me. So, yeah, teachers are super powerful. They can make those really great changes for kids, even inside a system that is pretty broken and hard for teachers.
I really recommend this book, even if you are scared of math like I am. It's called Mathish: Finding Creativity, Diversity, and Meaning in Mathematics. Joe Bowler, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for a great conversation. Got some good new ideas now.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.